Session number 12537, Herbert Bruster, Reel 3.
Mr. Bruster, Reel 3. You were telling me that you had virtually no duties in the transit camp.
That's right. We left Suez some 2 weeks after this, and I recall I was still very weak, and a couple of my friends carried my kit bag and one or two other things that I had to the trucks. We were going down to Suez Docks just to embark again from there.
Was this your whole draft that you travelled out from
England? Yeah, the 40 that we started with from the UK.
How was that actually structured? I mean, who was in? Did you have an officer in charge?
Yes, there was a lieutenant in charge of us. He was quite old for a lieutenant, a Lieutenant Thomas, so I can recall quite well, an artillery one. And the R.A. Thomas, I think his initials are. And he was with us until we got right through to the artillery depot in East Africa. So he was in, and there were one or two NCOs, senior NCO sergeants and things like that. But I would say probably in excess of 30 of us were straightforward gunners, stroke driver operators. Anyhow, we left there and went down to the docks at Suez and embarked on an old Belgian coal-burning boat called the Elizabethville. And this, I understand, had been rescued off a mud bank in the Congo some 2 years earlier and pressed into service. And it was doing a regular shuttle service between Suez and Mombasa in Kenya. We sailed from there the following morning, and we didn't like this boat at all. It was belching thick black smoke out all the way down, and there were no forced air facilities below deck at all. Now, all they had was windsocks up in the rigging of the masts, and hopefully if you were going into the wind, you would get a breeze down on the mess deck. So this was relaxed considerably, especially in the Red Sea, and we were allowed to sleep on decks because we were in what was considered a danger area from a submarine attack or anything like that, although blackout was rigorously observed. On the way down, we put into Port Sudan, and this was after about 2 days, and I never realised it could get so hot in any one place as it did there. We sailed into the docks about 7 in the morning, and by 9 o'clock they turned the hoses on the deck and it literally disappeared in steam. And we stayed there for a very short while, 4 or 5 hours, nobody went ashore, and then we sailed on down to Aden, where we underwent the formalities of coaling. And when you see coaling done with coolies with baskets on their back running across floating pontoons and then up a ramp at the side of the boat, and the boat disappears in a haze of coal dust, it's incredible. Everything is covered in coal dust, you know, even your food is. It gets everywhere. But that's how they refilled. And then, anyway, we were there 24 hours, and again, nobody went ashore. They would have been far better off if they'd given us a day's leave while this went on, but apparently it was explained afterwards why they didn't, was because these coolies, if they realised nobody on the boat, they would have ransacked it. And so you could only say you were there to look after your own equipment. So we sailed from there, and our next port of call was Mombasa, some 9 days later. It was a pretty slow boat. And normally it wouldn't have taken that long, but we didn't. We saw the coast on numerous occasions around the Horn of Africa and that sort of thing, but we didn't actually land until we arrived in Mombasa.
Did you have any alerts from out there?
No, nothing at all. We were even unescorted all the way down. There were no convoy or anything, which was rather odd because when we came back, some 2.5 years later, when I was coming home on leave, we had an escort of the Wolfbite, which was a bit odd. But there we go. I suppose, you know, if there was something there, they'd have used it, but there was nothing. So, anyway, we arrived in Mombasa, and we disembarked straight into a train. And this was quite a civilised train. It was hauled by a huge, great Bayer Garrett engine with a tender each end. One had the water in and one had the fuel, which was wood, and a massive great searchlight on the front of it and a cow catcher. Tremendous impression this engine gave us. We'd never seen one so big. And some 15 to 20 grey painted railway carriages on the back. We had seats, you know, this was a luxury after Egypt. And they even let Dane into bunks at night, although there wasn't enough for us, but each pair of seats, the back was one's bed and the seat was the other on each side, you know. And the windows, I can recall quite well, it had a glass window, an open window where there was nothing in it, and the other one a gauze. So you let the wall down at night, but just to get the gauze up, so that the insects couldn't get in at the lights, because there was a light in each compartment, you know, and it was quite civilised, it really was. Although there was no meals on board, only haversack rations, which were put on board. Anyway, this train took about 20 hours to get to Athi River, which was 18 miles southeast of Nairobi, some 5,000 feet up from the coast. But it was during the daytime, it was a marvellous trip because it was through huge, great areas of game. And there were many instances where you could look out of the carriage at the front and see the head of the train going that way. A lot of climbing to do, as you can imagine. But these engines cope with it, although you could almost get out and walk in some instances. But we arrived at Athi River the following afternoon, and we disembarked there, and there were trucks there just to take us into the camp, which was set on the side of a slope. It was all virtually all canvas, one or two main buildings. But we got in there, and we were allocated a tented camp, which were ordinary ridge tents, four to a tent. And life was a bit harsh again then. Perhaps we were unfortunate, but we had a battery commander allocated to us who was a South African, and he treated people like pigs, quite frankly. And I think he considered he was a colonial, and we'd come out and we were a nuisance to him. And I can remember him coming through the tents one morning, because the tents, as you imagine, the army are in absolute straight lines, and you used to open up the flaps each end, both ends, during the day, and you clean the floor up, you know, and all the kit done up on the beds. They were wooden frame beds with rope intermeshed, and all your kit on there.
Kit inspection.
Yeah, as for that, every morning it was, you see. And although they weren't always inspected, but I can remember him one morning going through there, and he literally turned every bed upside down and tipped everything on into the dirt, just like that, you know. And I think he thought he was treating us like the Africans, like he would the Africans, you know. And God knows how he treated them, but that was where it was. Anyhow, one evening, and we did have a canteen in there, in a permanent building there. It was quite big, and it was probably almost the size of an average warehouse in this country, but it dealt with quite a lot of people. But only English NCOs and gunners were allowed in there. No African allowed in there. And the officers had their own mess, you think. And suddenly he came marching in. He got up onto this platform at the end, and his name was Innes, Captain Innes. And he stood there with his hands on his hips and his feet astride, and he shaded for silence, and everybody stopped and looked round, you know, and the chap on the piano stopped. "I want you all to know," he said, "that Innes is not a bastard." And of course, some wag at the back said, "Prove it." And he wanted to know who it was, but nobody told him. And off he went. And that was the sort of man he was. He was jungle. He really was, you know. But that was typical of that sort of treatment you could get, if you weren't careful, from what we would call the real colonials in those days. I think they resented British people going out there.
What were the other people in the camp like, the NCOs?
Oh, yeah, well, they were ordinary British people, see, you know, British NCOs and officers, and they were fine, there were no problems. In fact, I do know, at the end, the day before we left there to go to a unit, two of the chaps actually went and complained to the adjutant about him. Now, we never, ever saw him again after. He never, ever came to a unit. So whether he stayed there, I don't know, or whether he got shifted on, he may have got posted straight out to India or Burma or something, because that's the way they used to do it, wasn't it? But he was the sort of man that made life unpleasant. And you know, the second day in there, we got down to the idea of why we were there. And we were told we were there for an Africanization course before joining the units. So, and they said, basically, that means you've got to learn Swahili, basic Swahili, and orally as well as writing. And you've got to know how to treat the African as you would in the colonial army. And somebody said, "Well, we're not in the colonial army." No, he said, but you've got to treat them the same way, because we can't have a differential between these units and the King's African Rifles, which is understandable. So this went on quite well, really. We used to do Swahili every afternoon, because that was the hottest time of the day, and you'd sit under a straw roof building with no sides, you know, and learn the Swahili, and the idea was to swat it up in the evening, and, you know, people did it because there's nothing else to do. And some people got very fluent, very fluent.
Who actually taught you the Swahili?
Oh, they were all British NCOs and officers, but they obviously had picked it up very, very well, and I would imagine they'd been on the permanent staff some while. But once you had passed it, you were not allowed to speak to an African in English. That just was not allowed. And the rest of it was really saying how you treated the African, and that if ever you passed an African soldier and he was sort of down on his haunches, as they usually are, you know, he had to get up and salute you. No matter what your rank was, he had to salute you. And if he didn't, you had to put him on a charge or give him a shove of your boot and remind him, you know. And that was the way it was put. Because nobody wanted to go to the trouble of sticking people on charges, because it was too much trouble.
Ignore the paperwork.
Ignore the paperwork, that's right. So anyhow, they did really stress this. It was most important. And they told you the background to them, the tribal conditions, and which tribes they were recruited from, and how they were recruited through the local district commissioners of each area. And what their arrangements for service was for the duration of the war, and they were entitled to 28 days leave every year back to their reserves, and transport would be laid on to take them back to the DC's office in that area, and then picked up from there 28 days later. All that was later explained. So you knew what it was all about when you went to a unit. So this lasted about 4 or 5 weeks, I suppose. And then I was posted to 307 East African Field Regiment, which was there at that time, stationed on the shore of Lake Naivasha. Very nice posting, actually. The railway was only... Well, the railway ran through Naivasha, the Nairobi to Kisumu Railway. And you could get on the train, although we never did, because they used to lay on a Liberty truck into Nairobi on a Friday night. And if you had a weekend pass, you'd stay on it till Sunday and stop in the nappy accommodation and come back on a Sunday night. And it was 65 miles north of Nairobi. It used to take a good three hours because it was a pretty awful road. It was no tarmac once you left the confines of Nairobi City. And that life was quite bearable there, really, because the lake itself was just down the road, and there's a lake hotel on the side of the lake, and it's still there now, and you could get a sailing dinghy out on the lake, and that, if you were prepared to pay for it, you know, or you could hire trucks at weekends and go off out into the bush on a bit of safari, or you could climb Longonot, which is an extinct volcano, which was 3 miles behind the camp, and that was interesting because you could see light game down in the crater. Anyhow, we did a lot of training there, a lot of advanced training across the bottom end of the Rift Valley, because that's where it is there, it's located there. And it really got you into unit life. The regiment was made up of three batteries, 6-6, 6-7, 6-8 field batteries, and I was 6-6. I know my CO, or OC for most of the time, was a Major Vivian Bennett. I believe he's dead now, but he was a charming man. Lived in Brighton before he came into the army. He was a wartime soldier, you know, but he was extremely professional. And we were always considered, because there was a lot of rivalry between the three, and there always is in a regiment, between the three batteries that who comes at top, and 6-6 being senior, he meant it to stay that way. And anyhow, we stayed in Naivasha for, this would have been, end of 44, September 44. We stayed there probably 18 months. And in fact, VJ was announced, VJ, while we were at Naivasha. And we had to lay on the victory parade of the artillery contingent in Nairobi for their victory parade. And the quads and the limbers and the 25-pounders were all balled up, and the jeeps, and everybody went off to Nairobi and had a whale of a time for 3 days, you know. And Then we came back from there, and then I'd been out there then 2 years, and I was awarded LEAP, that's Leave in Addition to Python. I got 28 days at home, and so I came home for the 28 days. I came home on a naval repair ship, which was sailing from Mombasa at the time, and it took us 42 days to get to Plymouth. It stopped everywhere. Everywhere you could think of, you know, Cyprus, Crete, Malta. Tour. Oh, it was lovely, really. It really was, because I was just killing time, you know. And I had my 20 days at home. There was 30 of us come home. Artillery people came home. And out of that 30, we reported back to Southampton Transit Camp on Bassett Common when we finished. And out of the 30, I was the only one posted back to the unit. The rest of them were given postings to an Aero P squadron at Bewley in the New Forest and somewhere else on Salisbury Plain. And I thought, well, that's just my luck. Anyway, when I got back there, I said to my boss, who was Lieutenant Lee, the quartermaster, and I said, why have I come back? Well, he said, I needed you back. Your employed staff is right, because I'd taken over as ration orderly just before I left, you see. He said the rest were only duty NCOs. So I had another year and a half there then. And then we disbanded 307 and reformed with 303, who had returned from Burma at that time, and transferred from Naivasha to Nanyuki Airfield.
Now, I'd like to ask a bit more about the Africanisation course.
Yep.
When you got to your 307,
yeah.
This was a unit with British...
British NCOs and officers and
African soldiers.
Yeah. Up to the rank of RSM. Mm. There was a British RSM and an African RSM, see. That's where the overlap was.
Did you have any African soldiers in the OP?
Yes, from there on, yes, they did. Well, they were used as signallers, and they were responsible for taking the telephone cables and that type of thing out. And, in fact, what happened in practice, they cut the wireless operator situation down from 2 to 1. So the wireless operator manned the wireless, but it was giving tuition to the African signallers, who were basically responsible for the telephone extensions.
So you had in your truck, then, you'd have yourself... Mm. An officer.
And an OP assistant.
An OP assistant.
Sergeant, he was.
Yeah. And an African.
Yeah. Sometimes one, sometimes two Africans.
Yeah. Do you remember which particular tribe yours came from?
Well, most of them came from the Wakamba. Quite a lot came from Tanganyika in those days, and Uganda. Probably more from Uganda than anywhere else. The local tribes weren't considered good enough, and they were Kikuyu. And they weren't. Well, they said just weren't trainable. So there were no Kikuyu in the army, to my knowledge, at all.
How did you find your Wakamba? Were they good?
They were quite good. I think you've got to realise, though, that the African has never been, in those days, let me put it right, except in the big cities, which was Nairobi or Mombasa and possibly Kisumu and places like that, they'd never been educated at all. And they literally came out of the bush. Now, you could train them to do a job after quite a while, but they could only do that one job. And one of the sort of highlights of it, you teach him to be a driver of a 3-ton truck. Now, that's fine, and he'd soon learn how to get up into top gear and away. But when it came to a steep hill, he'd keep going in top gear until it stopped. Then he'd have to put it in bottom and start again. He didn't have the know-how, if you like, or the aptitude to realise you had to change down to keep it going uphill. And the same on the guns. They'd never get a number one job on a gun, not as a team leader, but as 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6, they get it. But if you try to change them from number 2 to number 3, they were totally and utterly lost. Likewise, if you send them on leave, they go away in their number one khaki drill, you know, very smart and everything, with their coloured lanyards and all this sort of thing, and their bush hat on. And 28 days later, you pick them up, and if you're lucky, they'd have a blanket round them and might have a pair of old sandals on, but usually bare feet, and their boots and all are gone. You know, they'd sold them. They didn't consider that wrong, but of course it was given barrack stoppages then to pay for it when they got back, but they didn't consider that was wrong at all. But that's the way they were. They were very simple-minded, but you could, well, you provided you let them see that you were in charge and you weren't going to stand for any nonsense, they were fine. The instance is, like, we all have personal boys, but as NCOs, we didn't get one each. Usually it was one between four. And they were responsible for bringing your tea in the morning, first thing, you know, when you got up, because there was no reveille as such in those units. At sort of 6:30 in the morning or something. And then they would bring your canvas bucket of hot water to wash in, because that had to come from the cookhouse, you see. And although we were in wooden huts, I would stress, but they were pretty basic, and there were no linings on the inside of the walls or anything, you know, and there was a mesh around the top that high to let the air through. But these boys used to do that, and then they'd make your bed, which was a folding camp bed with a valise. We did have valise this time, we got these stuff here, on top, and they'd make them up, and they would then wash your clothes the day before, your khaki drill, and starched them, and wash all your clothes, in fact, and put them out to dry, because they used to hang on the bushes, and they'd do all that, and iron them with a charcoal iron. You sometimes get some scorch marks on them where the cinders came out the side, you know, but by and large, they did a good job, you know. But I think where I found they were better, when I took over the ration stores, regimental ration stores, I had 6 African storemen. Well, they were storemen come drivers, because I used to have to go to the central supply depot to pick up rations daily, you see, and bring back, and I'd take my own crew of Africans down there and drivers to get it all. And I used to usually take two 3-tonners and a jeep then, you see. And now they were, because they were doing the same job every day, they were extremely, extremely good. And you didn't have to tell them each day after the rations had been issued, all right, I want this place cleaned up. There was water tipped on the floor, and the place was scrubbed with bus brooms and everything, you know, especially the butcher shop part of it, because there was no electrical freezing at all. Or you had a place which was a double skin of a type of, well, it was, I suppose it was a bit like chipboard, only double section, a gap in between, and there's gauze around the top and a woven roof. And it was surprisingly cool it kept, and you could hang the meat in there for up to 24 hours and it was no problem. But you know, this was one of the skills of ration orderly. You had to use up fresh food fairly quickly among the kitchens.
Manage the flow.
Yeah, that's right. And you couldn't sort of save some for the next day because it would go off. But these Africans were very good at those sort of things. And once I'd got them working my way, and I had one of them, a senior to the other, he was a Lance Bombardier, who even learnt a bit, and he used to check inventory sheets and stock controls and things, you know. And, okay, he knew I was doing spot checks behind him every so often, but he used to do them, and they were very reliable.
What was their temperament like?
Well, it was quite good, providing you treated them right. And I never, ever knew an African soldier to run amok to strike a European. Whether it was because they were so scared of the consequences, I don't know. But I never knew that. There were one or two riots among themselves, and the worst one I saw was in the depot before we left there, where one of them was given corporal punishment. And as I said earlier, we had to form the Africans up in 3 ranks around 3 sides of a square, and we as British NCOs stood behind them all the way around with pickaxe handles. And the instructions were, if they broke ranks, you had to threaten them with them, and if they didn't go back, you had to use them. Well, it never got to the stage of using them. The instructions we had, we could have used them, but we didn't. You know, we pushed them and shoved them, and they got back in. But this African RSM, he inflicted the corporal punishment with this strap thing, and to be on a bare back, you know. And to be honest, I think he loved doing it. He was, I suppose when you get to that rank as an African, you reach the top of the tree, and that's what it's all about, its status. And but the Africans, there was a lot of grumbling going on, you know, amongst them, and they started shuffling their feet and everything, and so we had to bark a few orders at them, and they dropped back into line, even though they were surly about it. But we didn't have to get the stage where we had to use anything on them at all. But the only other time I saw it happen, and it wasn't as bad as that, We were up in the northern frontier at Archer's Post, and there was an African who was given a direct order by a British NCO in Swahili. Now, I know he got it right because I heard him say it, and he was quite good. He was better than I was at Swahili. And he walked away from him, and when he came back, this African hadn't done it. Now, he was of a tribe, and I'm not sure what they were, but he was an odd man out, if you like. He wasn't as brown as the others. He wasn't as paler altogether, you know. And he had a different outlook in life, a much prouder sort of outlook. And he didn't want to do this job. And anyway, when he came back, he hadn't done it. And he started shouting and screaming, this African did. And they had to actually physically restrain him in the end and lock him up in the back of a truck for 24 hours, you know. And when he came out, he was fine. And there was no problem. And, of course, that happens among British ranks as well. But it did highlight it a bit there. I think the biggest problem I had once, I would stay behind on the rear party once, and this was because I had to go to Nairobi to the eye specialists, and we were at Naivasha at the time, and they were going up to Isiola, just north of Isiola on the northern frontier, and the whole regiment were going up there for an advanced exercise. About 3 days after they went up, I went up with more rations and with the mail, and the orders in those days were, if you've got an African driver, the African must drive, you see. You weren't allowed to drive the truck as a European. So we got up there and got to the camp, and I turned around to this African in Swahili and I said, told him, go and get a cup of tea from the mess and come back and wait at the truck. Oh, and dear, and dear, and dear, he agreed, you know. When I came back, about 2 hours later, I'd had some lunch and been distributed the mail and things, you know, because we'd unloaded the rations beforehand, and he was missing, so was the truck. So I went around the wagon lines and said, where is he? And this bombardier, African bombardier, he said he'd returned to the depot, that I'd instructed him to return. And I thought, right. The next day there was another truck coming up, so I went back on that. And when I got back, I got on with him, and I asked him what the game was. And he said, oh, I understood that you said something. So. Well, he didn't, because, you know, I knew enough Swahili for him to understand. He was trying to put one over on me. So I had my own back, and they'd asked me, before they left, if I could build a cricket pitch. Now, the ground is pretty rough out there, you know. There was no parade ground of tarmac or anything like that. It was a big area of barren land with grass on, bare grass. And they used to use it for the parade ground and football, cricket and everything. And a couple of the officers there said, who were keen cricketers, said, could you build a cricket pitch for me, right? I said, well, I don't know what really goes into a cricket pitch, but I go, why? They said, well, basically what it is the length and the width of the cricket pitch, you see? And they gave me that. They said, really what you want to do is dig it right out, put some hardcore of some sort in the bottom, and then some wet sand and bed it down, and then get some of this stuff from the obsidian. Well, the obsidian was lava, you see, overflow from the volcano, and work it in between it. And they said, you'll get as good a surface as you will if you wet it, you see, as you can, and then put a sprinkling of earth over the top, and that would do. The main thing is to get the bumps out of it, you see. So I thought, right, just the boy for this job. And I had him on that, amongst others, you know. We give him a relief that a different party each day, but I put him on it for 6 days on the trot. He didn't step out of line again. He was back on my ration team afterwards, but he never stepped out of line again. But that was one way of getting back at him. But it was a problem. If they thought you didn't really know Swahili, some of them could, you know, pull a fast one on you.
Do you think the Africanisation course was a good introduction?
Yes, it was essential, because I realised afterwards that you had to know Swahili for a start, because if you let the African speak to you in English, he would talk down to you. He was better than you, and at that time it was essential that no African could consider himself better than the European. Today it would be a different story, obviously, but in those days that was essential to get the discipline out of them, you see. Because that was an instance where he thought he was better, and he hopped it. Mm. So, I think that was essential. I really do.
When this African was being flogged, do you know what he was being flogged for?
No, I don't, because he wasn't from our battery. There were three batteries in this training depot, and I don't know. He'd been in the what we called the caboose, a wire mesh compound, for a couple of 3 days then, because I'd seen him a couple of times in the evening with his rifle above his head and his backpack on, doubling round and round it with an African NCO stood there, you know, making sure he doubled all the time with a cane in his hand. But it wasn't uncommon. I understand in the King's African Rifles, it was far more common, because there you didn't have any, or very, very few British NCOs. You had British officers, and the rest were Africans. So they had to keep a much tighter control.
Now, I think you said that you were attached to the 5th King's African Rifles.
Yeah, this was basically when we went to Nanyuki, because we went up there with the idea of forming a complete unit, because we were going to be seconded to the 11th East African Division in Burma, basically. And, of course, the war ended and we never got there. But it was being formed as a complete battalion with all its support. In other words, there was the artillery, there were the REMI, the engineers and everything, and they were all being grouped in the Nanyuki area, because Nanyuki was a brigade area in its